is United States versus Fred Davis Clark and Ms. Silvers. It will kick us off. Thanks so much.
Thank you. May it please the court. I'm Marcia Silvers, and with me at counsel's table is Claudia Pastoris. She's the co-counsel. We represent Dave Clark, and we've raised, as you know, many issues, all of which I believe are important. I'd like to address the ones that I think are most fundamental, and of course, welcome any questions on any of the arguments. The first issues I'd like to address are the denial of the advice of counsel and theory of defense instructions, both of which were given in the first trial. And I think it's important to note that the error here with respect to the advice of counsel instruction is that the trial court himself made a determination that as a matter of law, Clark did not rely in good faith on advice of counsel. But it's well settled law in this circuit that that's a question for the jury when there's any foundation in the evidence to support the instruction, and regardless of how dubious, insufficient, or weak it is. So viewing the evidence in the light most favorable to Clark, as required, he satisfied the very low burden, extremely low burden, that he had here.
Just so I'm clear, so it's enough that the lawyers never sort of gave explicit sanction, that he sort of flagged for them what he intended to do, and they sat silent?
They were aware of it, and they participated in it. And yes, they never told him that it was improper.
And I just want to make sure that as a matter of law, that's enough, that they never, that he said, here's what I intend to do, in effect, and they never spoke up to countermand it. Not that they gave him kind of the thumbs up.
Viewing it in the light most favorable to Clark as required, and because it can be satisfied regardless if the evidence is even insufficient. It's just if there's any evidence whatsoever. Yes, I believe that his testimony, and he actually, in some of the matters, he actually testified that, for example, he told his attorneys he was providing the cash to close on his relative's mortgage loans, and no attorney told him it was improper.
But you understand my question,
yes,
right? I'm just trying to make, easy peasy, I think, if he says, I'm using my own cash to close these transactions, and the attorneys say, good to go. Mm-hmm. A little bit different, right, if he says, I'm using my own cash to close these transactions, then the attorneys just stare at him.
It is a little bit different, but it's still an extremely low threshold, and viewing it in light most favorable to Clark, I would say he clearly met that threshold. And also there is other evidence besides Clark's testimony that shows that he sought the attorney's advice, and that would be that there is a wire credit for cash to close on one of the family member loans that shows the cash came from a K Club's entity called CC Realty, not the borrowers, that was sent to Attorney Callahan. And he clearly knew and participated in the fact that the cash to close was coming from Clark for the family member loans. It's undisputed. He sent an email to Attorney Bill Lee, who was one of the attorneys at K Clubs, and he asked him if it was a problem that he was going to set up the family mortgage loans in order to satisfy the Orion curtailment payment. There is an email in evidence where he's actually asking that. So it's not just his testimony. Even if it was just his testimony, of course, that would be sufficient.
My question is more about the evidence with respect to the lawyer's response.
Yes.
You know, that you know, you tend to think of an advice of counsel defense or advice of counsel instruction where there was actually some advice given.
Yes, and he testified that he regularly met with these people, and he told them, and they discussed all of the K Club's real estate transactions. He always sought their advice. If he's in a room with them, and he's discussing with them that he's going to do this deal to satisfy the Orion curtailment payment, and he's going to do this cash to close, and he wants to know what they think of it. Clearly, they're all in the room with him. No one says no. He says, "Well, then I can do it." I mean, that to me, and with this low threshold, is clearly enough.
Ms. Silver, he testified, did he not, that he instructed staff to, although he objects to the term, to forge signatures?
Yes, he
okay,
did.
Okay, now, this case in our circuit, Condon here in the 11th Circuit, says that that the standard isn't met if the conduct in question is obviously dishonest. Okay? Obvious dishonesty is the phrase they use.
Well,
so you have not only no affirmative response from the lawyers, but then what appears to be something obviously dishonest.
Well, Your Honors, I don't know if they thought it was obviously dishonest.
The question is whether it is. This is an objective question.
Yeah. Well, I know that there is evidence, yes, that he told his attorneys that the personnel were signing his relatives and his friends' names on the mortgage loan documents. And while that might be forgery, because it was done with permission.
Well, advice of counsel would not cover,
maybe the attorneys,
would not cover a murder or killing, okay? And here what we've got is not only having others forge the signatures, but forge notarizations as well.
Right? Forge what?
Notarizations.
Yes.
On loan documents.
Yes. That's true. That's
so,
true.
I mean, maybe you have an attorney who's is an idiot, or this is simply just doesn't meet the standard.
The attorneys were required to know the law, and they were not indicted as co-conspirators or referred to as co-conspirators in this case or co-defendants. They were referred to as competent, good attorneys who gave him advice. And he had four different law firms that gave him advice.
Switched their position in this case, didn't they? As things went along, am I in the right case on that? Callahan switching his position?
Callahan did not testify. He took the Fifth Amendment.
Right.
Yes.
But he had testified previously.
That's correct.
And he's one of the lawyers, is he?
Yes, he was one of the lawyers. Mm-hmm. And yes, anyway, Your Honor, moving on to what he testified that he was told, or that he told his lawyers, he didn't just talk about it in vague terms. He said, "I told them all the details of setting up the family mortgage loans to satisfy the payment." I mean, what more could he do? There's evidence that he told them. He testified that he told them. I really feel like if this case doesn't meet the standard, no case is going to meet the standard.
Well, let's not overstate it. I mean, the paradigmatic case is where the lawyer actually speaks up and says, "You have my explicit sanction to do this." So there are lots of cases that meet the standard. Your position may be, if this case of tacit approval doesn't meet the standard, then no case of tacit approval does.
Better said, thank you.
Well, perhaps a case of tacit approval with conduct that's not obviously dishonest.
Mm-hmm.
Or where lawyers are not obviously dishonest and not indicted or co-conspirators, and are people like law firms like Greenberg Traurig, Gray Robinson. These are the lawyers that he had involved in this case.
Wasn't it in terms of saying that he would have others make the signatures, forge the signatures.
Mm-hmm.
Wasn't that in-house counsel?
He just said he told his attorneys. I don't think he was specific as to which attorneys. Schwartz was the one-third owner who was the CFO.
Okay,
he was also an accountant.
Mm-hmm.
Also, Your Honor, just wanted to, before I move on to my next argument, just say that the good faith instruction did not cover this at all. The good faith instruction says no intent to defraud if the defendant believes.
That's pretty clear.
Okay, thank you, Your Honors.
Question about the, is there anything at all on the record as to how much money these lawyers were paid?
You know, I don't believe there is.
Or how they were paid, whether it was paid by closing or
I don't believe that came out, Your Honor.
Lee was kind of a house counsel, was he not?
Yes, he was a house counsel.
We know what his salary was?
I certainly don't, and I don't think the record reflects that, Your Honor.
So we're totally in the dark. All we know is we had the lawyers doing some work, but
yes.
We don't know what they were paid for.
We don't
or
know.
How much they were paid for that, but how much they were paid.
No, the government never thought that was relevant to bring in, and it was not admitted.
I asked the question because the amount of money lawyers were getting may have been an incentive to go along with what he wanted to do.
Yes, and I can probably provide that information to you if I can find it anywhere in the record, but I don't recall anything in the record. And as far as the harm here, I just think it's very important to note that if he relied on counsel, he's innocent. That's it. And these instructions were given in the first trial. There were no convictions. So I think that, you know, and also the fact that this error.
He said an opening statement without any objection.
I'm sorry.
The opening statement to the jury.
The opening statements, yes.
It talks about the lawyers.
Yes, and that's true.
There was no objection.
And he talks about that they're going to testify. Yes, he does in the opening statements. But he was never allowed to present those two lawyers that he talked about. That was Callahan and Phoenix who took the fifth. And then during the closing, he was not allowed at all to testify, to argue.
The preliminary that was filed in the earlier on was denied, the government's motion. Or his motion was not overruled, I'll put it that way.
Yeah. At first, the judge actually, on the advice of counsel, said he was going to reserve and on the government's motion, and then later,
that explains,
you know what
I
happened.
Think probably why there was no objection to the opening statement.
Right. So there was a double whammy in not giving Clark's theory of defense instruction. And, of course, the same standard applies. And when viewed in the light most favorable to Clark, it was clearly met. It was given in the first trial, and it was substantially the same in the second trial. Plainly, there was no waiver here also. I don't know if the court is concerned about that. I addressed that a lot in my brief because they argued there was waiver, but the fact is that the court came in at the charge conference. He said, I'm going to deny the theory of defense instruction and three others, and then defense counsel objected later. He said, I'm going to give you time to object. And so then later on, the defense counsel objected to the denial of each of those four instructions by how it was titled when he filed it. So, for example, if he objected to advice of counsel, he said, advice of counsel, judge, and then the judge would say denied. So when the theory of defense instruction came up, he said, theory of defense, it's very similar to the theory of defense instruction which we submitted and was given in the first trial. Clearly, he's referring to his entire theory of defense instruction and comparing it to the one in the first trial.
Where are you in the record on this?
And then...
Ms. Silvers, where in the record are you?
Okay, this is all at DE 599, 177 to 78. And he goes on to say, we're entitled to our theory of defense given to the jury by way of instruction. So it was preserved. And only after the court again said no, he wasn't going to give it, the counsel say, all right. And then later he renewed it, and he filed a motion for post-trial relief based on it. So that was clearly preserved.
D as in dog 599, correct?
Docket.
I call it DE. I meant docket entry. Docket entry 599, which is the charge conference.
Which of these many volumes is that to be found?
There's a lot of volumes in this case.
I haven't.
Believe me, I know that.
177 to 78.
Yes. That's where that comes in, where he's objecting to the theory of defense instruction. So, you know, with the law the way it is, he should have been given that. And it's just not right. It's not fair. And our case law recognizes this. I invite the court's attention to the Ruiz case and the Burstyn case and a million other cases that we've cited.
I think we should probably stop you there. You're about 2 minutes over, unless Judge Ginsburg has a follow-up question about the record.
She has time for rebuttal?
Rebuttal,
yes.
Yeah, you've reserved time for rebuttal. We'll take it up on rebuttal.
Oh, thank you.
Very good, thank you. All right, Mr. Kane.
Good morning, Your Honors, and may it please the court. Daniel Kane for the United States. I'd like to address Mr. Clark's argument about the advice of counsel defense and any other questions the court may have. To begin with, I don't think the standard is quite as permissive as my colleague would suggest. And I think the key case on this point is Hill, cited in our brief. And that postdates the cases on which Mr. Clark relies, both Kotwitz and Eisenstein. That case is quite on point factually. And that case explains that in order to qualify for an advice of counsel defense, the defendant must show both that he fully disclosed to his attorneys all material facts that are relevant to the advice for which he consulted the attorney, and thereafter, he relied in good faith on advice given by his attorney.
Isn't Hill, though, a little bit different? In Hill, you didn't even have consultation, right? I mean, did you have the sort of close consultation in Hill that you that at least she claims they had here?
No, Your Honor. In that case, it was limited to the fact that Mr. Hill employed attorneys and had them during the relevant period of time. And I agree that there wasn't consultation in Hill, but we, of course, would argue that there wasn't the material consultation in this case. And I'd like to turn to that.
Yeah.
I think if we get granular about what exactly Mr. Clark testified to at trial, I think it's clear that he didn't testify that he gave his attorneys all of the material information. So on direct examination, he adduced, I think, three key facts about what he did with his attorneys. One.
Counsel, you have to deal with a lot of inferences in these arrangements.
That's right, Your Honor, I think.
Between the lawyers and the client.
I think that's fair, Your Honor,
especially for what purposes are the lawyers there?
That's right, Your Honor, and I have no quarrel with defense counsel that the record in the district court should be construed in favor of the defendant.
Just relying on express statements made by Clark and the lawyers in response, in my view, is pretty thin.
I agree that the record evidence here is thin.
I'm concerned with the inferences that can be drawn from the testimony that he gave about the setting in which they were working.
Fair enough, Your Honor, and I'm happy to discuss what we think the permissible inferences are, but I think it may be helpful just to ground exactly in what he testified to. So he testified that he consulted with his attorneys on all of his business activities, that he consulted with them on how he structured the particular transactions at issue in this case, including that he provided the cash to close on these transactions, and that he told his attorneys that he would direct his employees to sign names on behalf of his family members. Now, that doesn't speak to the fraud that was actually perpetrated here, because the fraud wasn't the structuring of the transactions. The fraud wasn't the signing of other names. The fraud was failing to disclose that information or misrepresenting that information to the banks. And there's simply no testimony in the record that he told attorneys, for instance, that he would misrepresent who the borrower was to the banks. He never testified that he would fail to disclose to the banks that the notarizations on the applications were false. He never testified that he would give false information. I'm sorry, he never testified that he told his attorneys he would give false information to the banks about the borrower's employment or their salaries. That's really the heart of what he needed the advice of counsel on. He needed advice of counsel as to whether he could misrepresent material matters to the banks. And as I think Judge Ginsburg...
He knew that the signatures were not going to be of the borrowers. And he told the lawyers that. We can draw the inference that the lawyers assumed that he was going to give that information to the bank, like that.
That's right, Your Honor. I think it's fair to draw an inference that the attorneys knew he would give that information to the bank. What I'm not sure is...
These conversations were not just with a straw meeting that were meaningless.
That's right, Your Honor, but I still think, for instance, with respect to the signatures, there's nothing inherently unlawful, as I think is hashed out in the briefs in this case, about signing on behalf of someone else, but what's necessary is to have power of attorney. I think it would have been sufficient on that particular element of the fraud had Mr. Clark consulted with his attorneys and said, I'm going to submit to the bank signatures that not only are on behalf of other people, but without those other people having granted power of attorney. That I think that would be sufficient to trigger the instruction, though I would emphasize that that would only be one small facet of the fraud here. It wouldn't capture the fundamental misrepresentation here that Mr. Clark would be submitting loan applications and loan documents to banks that fundamentally misrepresent who the borrower was. And that's really an essential element of what banks need to know, as this court made quite clear in Hill. And I think to fail to inform counsel of that fact is to fail to disclose all the material information.
Well, you're squeezing that theory down to something very narrow. So now you've got to tell the lawyers, I'm going to have other people sign for me. And by the way, I'm not going to tell the bank.
Well, Your Honor, I think it's a question of getting advice as to what the illegality was here. I don't think it's, for instance, I think we'd all agree, as Hill held, that it's not enough merely to have lawyers. Now, one conceivably might draw an inference, well, I have lawyers, and if I have lawyers, I consult
them. The lawyers knew exactly what the bank wanted. They knew what the application forms called for. Isn't that a clear inference?
Perhaps, Your Honor, I wouldn't draw that inference so readily, because
these are lawyers, they're swamped at this point in time in our economy down in Florida. They're closing these loans, not just in this situation, so fast they can hardly count them.
Fair enough, Your Honor, but
I would suggest that there's an inference that these lawyers knew everything there is to know about making these loans and submitting these applications and what the banks would rely on.
Perhaps, Your Honor, I think that's outside
the record.
You don't
think that's a fair inference?
Perhaps it is, but I'd really like to emphasize.
Stupid lawyers, I suppose.
Well, I'd really like to emphasize.
Why would you have them there?
Good question, Your Honor. Why would you have them there? Lawyers serve a variety of different purposes in a corporation, and I think to have Mr. Clark testify that he told his lawyers how these transactions would be structured, which is what he
testified. These lawyers were present time after time. What's the size of the volume altogether of these loans?
Millions of dollars. Right.
Wasn't it 1,400 transactions?
Yeah.
I agree that there are many transactions. There's no doubt about it.
Those lawyers didn't know what the banks required and what he was doing. That's almost unbelievable.
Fair enough, Your Honor. I think it's likely that
unless they were just mannequins sitting there.
So if he goes to his lawyers and he says, I'm going to submit a no-doc loan application, one thing. But what if he comes in with me and says, I'm going to submit a liar loan application?
No, of course not. I don't think, I mean, I'm sorry. I don't think the fraud in here is in submitting a no-doc loan application.
If it's a liar loan.
Well, right. Query what we mean by liar loan exactly. But to the extent he's making misrepresentations to the bank, I think he has to disclose to his attorneys that he is going to misrepresent facts.
You want us to write an opinion which says that this defense turns on whether or not the Clark told the lawyers that he intended to defraud the banks.
No, you're right.
In the following respects. In the following respects, just a minute. And then he gets the attorney-client privilege. Is that I hear you say?
No, Your Honor, I don't mean to say that.
Well, tell me how much of the crime does he have to tell the lawyers before he proceeds?
Your Honor, I think that's an interesting and difficult question.
Well, I want you to tell me, because I have another question that would follow that.
At minimum, I think he needs to disclose to his attorneys that he's going to tell the bank something that's not true.
Saying that he's telling the banks not true, and they sat there. Okay. In which event the crime fraud exception to the privilege evaporates. You agree with me?
Yes, Your Honor.
He sits there and tells the lawyers what he's going to do, and they, in effect, put the rubber stamp on it. You agree? There's no, the crime fraud exceptions blows away the client privilege for purposes of evidence, for purposes of making the lawyers testify.
Likely, yes.
Okay, and they become aiders and abettors in the fraud.
Conceivably, Your Honor, though it might
they become aiders and abettors in the fraud, which is why there's no, that's your argument, that there's no defense.
The argument is, Your Honor, that there's no testimony here that Mr.
No,
Clark.
No, I'm getting to your theory. Your theory is they have to tell the lawyers, in effect, that he's going to commit a wrong.
No, I don't think that's right, Your Honor. I'm sorry. I think I misexplained.
I thought you said that he has to tell the lawyers that he's going to do false things to the bank.
I'm sorry, Your Honor. I think there was an embedded premise there that I should have made a little clearer. I think he has to speak to his lawyers about what he's actually going to put on the statements he makes to the banks.
Well, there's an inference in what he's going to put on the shows the lawyers know what's going to be on the applications.
Fair enough, Your Honor.
Agree with that?
Yes, and I think it may be helpful. I think you're right that
the lawyers are going to give it to the bank. He's going to give it to the bank.
That he's going to give it to the bank.
Yeah, what he shows the lawyers, he's going to give to the bank, and the lawyers know that their signatures were signed for somebody else.
That's right. I think with respect to the signatures, but not with respect to the fact that he was going to misrepresent who he was to the bank, not to the fact that he was going to be paying the cash to close to the bank. There's just no testimony.
What exactly did he have to tell the lawyers so that what are the words he had to tell the lawyers in order not to have the defense?
Well, I think at a minimum in this case, he would have had to disclose to his attorneys not just that he would be providing the cash.
No, give me the language to the lawyer so that he doesn't have the defense.
That I will be...
Well, he does have the defense, I'll put it that way.
Fair enough. I think it would have to be a lot because there were a lot of misrepresentations on these documents, but at a minimum, I think...
What you're saying is he basically has to confess to the lawyers what he's doing wrong.
No, Your Honor, I don't think he would have to confess that he was committing a crime. I do think he would have to speak to his lawyers
about
what he was
doing. Well, just bordering on a crime.
Well, you want him to say, not only I'm going to submit this to the bank, but I'm going to submit this to the bank and I'm not going to tell them what I just told you.
Well, Your Honor, I think it's sufficient in this case to hold that he needs to say I'm going to submit it to the bank, which he did not testify to at this trial. But
what's a loan application for if it's not to submit it to the bank?
Oh, no, Your Honor. When he was I think that's right about the signature issue, but he didn't testify with respect to the cash to close issue, with respect to how he structured these transactions, that he was going to communicate that information to the bank. Instead, these lawyers may have played a different role, as Your Honor suggested. Lawyers do different things in corporations, and among them, they may address how the company structures its loans without
respect. Now we're going back to what we can discern from his testimony about the conferences that he had with these lawyers who represented him time and again in hundreds of transactions, thousands.
Fair enough, Your Honor.
House counsel. The reason for house counsel is because the lawyer's going to oversee it.
That's correct, Your Honor.
Okay.
Let me try to propose what I think may be a simpler way to resolve this question.
I'm trying to tease out.
Let me propose, I agree that it's a knotty issue, and teasing out exactly what would have to be said is a difficult question. I think there's an easier way to resolve this question, and I think it goes back to Judge Newsom's question with my colleague before, which is leaving aside what he disclosed and whether he identified the necessary material information to his attorney, there's a second element of the Hill test, and that second element is that he relied in good faith on advice given by counsel. He did not testify that he received any advice from his counsel.
So then is your position that we...
Sit down and talk to a lawyer and tell him everything you're going to do, and you proceed. What do you infer? What does the client infer? What's a permissible inference?
Your Honor, I don't think that merely, for instance, I don't think that merely telling...
The client can't draw an inference is what you're telling me. The client tells the lawyer a bunch of things, and the lawyer sits there and doesn't object or anything else. And the lawyer is the skilled person, by the way, the one who really does know what the law requires. And then the lawyer says nothing, and the client goes and does it.
Well, Your Honor, my
point
is that
you can't draw an inference from that that it's okay with the lawyer?
I think under some circumstances, there may be facts under which it's permissible to draw an inference from an attorney's silence that was sufficient for the defendant to move forward on the implicit advice of counsel. But this court held in Hill, in that case, this court held that implied advice of counsel is enough. That's from Hill itself. And I would note, by the way, in the record of this case, defense counsel, when on Mr. Clark's redirect examination, defense counsel, when he tried to ask
Your argument
Mr.
is
Mr. Clark,
he had told the defense counsel, well, you say he should have told the defense counsel. The defense counsel now becomes an aider and abettor in a crime. That's your testimony. That's your argument.
I don't think it has to go quite that far, Your Honor. I don't think that the...
Where do we draw the line?
I do think it's a difficult question to draw the line on which, what information...
You've got to tell the lawyers enough that the lawyers know he's going to commit a crime or he's going to do something wrong.
I think at a minimum, he needs to communicate to the lawyers that he's going to be communicating these facts.
In this case, he didn't communicate that he was going to do something wrong, and if he had, the lawyers would become aider and abettor in the crime.
Not just doing something wrong, Your Honor. I think he has to seek advice on the actual matter.
That's why the two of them took the Fifth Amendment.
Perhaps so, Your Honor, and indeed, perhaps so, Your Honor.
We're going to give you a couple of minutes. Just so I'm clear, though, I thought what you were about to say is, following on Judge Newsom's question, he didn't receive any advice, to which I was going to respond and ask you, is it your position then that there is no such thing as tacit approval, tacit advice of counsel? But I took in your response to Judge Choflat that is not your position.
No, Your Honor, I don't think there's no such thing as tacit advice of counsel. I think by analogy to Kotwitz, which is an accounting case, I think it's fair to say there, when a client gives his accountant all of his tax materials and asks the accountant to prepare tax filings, I think it's fair to say that the client is relying implicitly on the accountant's advice that what the accountant ends up filing, where there's evidence that, for instance, the client never reviewed those filings. I think this case is a far cry from that, where there's no testimony as to this pre-existing relationship between Mr. Clark and his counsel, where whatever the counsel, even where the counsel doesn't say anything, Mr. Clark assumes that that's going to be sufficient to protect him from any potential liability. I just don't think the record here would support that. And so, no, Your Honor, I don't think the instruction was necessary here. And I understand, Judge Joflat, that in the prior colloquy with my colleague that...
I'll just wrap it up this way. The lawyers had a duty to the client, to the people the client was dealing with, a professional obligation to do that.
So did the attorneys
have... lawyers had a professional obligation, in effect, to tell the client whether what he's doing is okay. They had that professional obligation, and also to the banks.
I'm not sure their obligations ran to the bank.
No, you don't think they did? You don't think a lawyer has a professional obligation, in effect, to the banks to tell the lawyer you can't do that?
To tell the client you can't do
Yeah, tell the client, yes.
Well, I think the... Maybe I'm quibbling, and I'm not sure this
you
matters.
You think it's a maybe about that?
Well, I think the attorney, as, you know, a good-standing member of society, has a duty to make sure that nobody...
No, not a member of society. This is a professional who's hired to help the client. Are you contending that there are some things that the lawyer doesn't have to tell the client about, that the client may be doing wrong?
No, Your Honor, I think upon consultation and upon disclosure of the material facts, I think the attorney has a duty to give counsel to his client.
The lawyer's supposed to sit there with the client and ask questions, counsel. You don't just rely on what one side, what the client says. You a good lawyer ask lots of questions.
All of this...
We can't infer that a good lawyer in these cases wouldn't have done that?
Your Honor, the government's position here is that there's simply not enough in this record to substantiate those kinds of inferences.
And so we cannot infer what a good lawyer would have done. We can take judicial notice of that, can't we?
I'm not sure, Your Honor. I think Your Honor, of course, can take judicial notice of the canons of ethics, and I'm just not sure that this court can take judicial notice of what good lawyers tend to do. No. So I'm happy to address any of the other issues raised in...
Before we lose you...
I apologize for taking it.
As you know, Ms. Silvers closed with a brief reference to 177 and 78 in this DE 599. So you're arguing that there's a forfeiture, as I understand it, with regard to the theory of defense?
Specifically with regard to the theory of defense instruction, but I think the government is prepared to agree that the advice of counsel defense was fairly preserved. The objection to the failure to give the advice of counsel defense was fairly preserved. And I do think the theory
of defense. Yes, I'm talking about the theory of the defense instruction.
There are actually two instructions, Your Honor. There was specifically an advice of counsel defense and a theory of defense.
I understand that. We've been discussing the former, and I want to ask you about the latter.
Absolutely.
I thought you were arguing it was forfeit.
That's right, Your Honor, though I'm not sure the issue is actually that significant, because I think the heart of the theory of defense instruction, I suspect my colleague would agree, the heart of the advice of the theory of defense instruction was really the advice of counsel instruction. And so I think it's fair to say that those two issues rise and fall together.
You're not arguing that the first one was forfeit.
That's right, Your Honor.
So you want to win on the merits with regard to the theory of defense. Let's just get beyond that. Ask you, was it forfeit? I thought you argued that.
We did, Your Honor. But again, I think there's reversible error here if the advice of counsel instruction, if the refusal to give the advice of counsel instruction was, if the refusal was itself erroneous.
You're not going to defend the forfeiture claim?
But I would on the theory of defense instruction, Your Honor.
That's what I'm asking you to do.
Right.
So why was it forfeit?
I think the argument in the brief, which I agree, I don't think that's the government's strongest argument in this brief, that, to be fair, that the theory of defense
you want to waive it?
Is forfeited. I think so, Your Honor. I think the heart of this case really is the advice of counsel.
You want to waive the forfeiture? Okay.
Yes, Your Honor.
All right with me. Yep. That's okay here.
Very well. Thank you so much.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Ms. Silvers, you've got 3 minutes remaining.
Just briefly with respect to the Hill case, and I think the court also touched on this, that case is clearly distinguishable from this case because there the only evidence was that he hired lawyers and there was zero other evidence. With respect to the argument that Clark didn't tell the lawyers that he was going to misrepresent the borrowers to the banks, if that was the argument, I think it's clear that he, and the record is clear, that he told his attorneys all the details, he said, about setting up the family mortgage loans to satisfy the Orion curtailment payment. And so they knew that this information was going to be submitted to the bank, clearly. So that's that. As far as the fact that they're claiming that he didn't tell the lawyers about the false notarizations. He never said that he didn't tell them about the false notarizations. And they do touch on that in their brief. And they try to say that that he didn't tell an attorney, Allison, on one count, count two, which is one of the family member counts, about notarizations. But that Allison was not Clark's attorney. Okay, he was an attorney for another real estate developer. So that is completely a red herring. And they also went on to ask him, well, you didn't disclose to any attorney that a specific document had on that count had a false notarization. And he really said, I don't know as to that document, looking at that document. And he tried to explain and he was cut off, which is another argument that we have all together. And I know I didn't touch on it, so I can't talk about it here. But, I mean, the fact is, there was a lot of information that we definitely think that he satisfied his low threshold, and he did. But there was so much information that he was prevented from testifying about and presenting here that alone, I submit, is reversible error. And
does your argument about the theory, about the instructions leave any counts standing unaffected?
No. The counts now that the court is looking at are the bank fraud counts and the SEC charge. The SEC charge is mentioned in the theory of defense that he gave them a lot of thousands of documents. And
why isn't the court on solid ground in saying that? With that testimony provides no factual basis for a claim as a defense to the SEC.
Good question. Here's the advice of counsel on the SEC. He gave his lawyer, Cox, all his documents this is all his testimony, regarding the SEC matter, and then Cox prepared and produced all those documents to the SEC. that he's accused of not producing in total. So he relied on him to do that. And then Cox represented him at the SEC deposition that's the subject of the SEC count, Cox the lawyer, and was there to advise him throughout the period of the deposition. So he, you know, he clearly had him there. He relied on him to give him advice about the statements that he was making. One of the arguments that the government made was that Clark testified in that deposition that he didn't own any of the units. The reason is that he had been told that...
By whom?
What?
Told by whom?
He had been told by Schwartz, the CFO, and his lawyers, that it was okay to buy properties in family member names, so he didn't think these were straw borrower loans. And his lawyer was present when he gave that testimony. So for all those reasons, if the court is going to rule favorably on this issue, we submit that it should reverse on all the counts. And unless the court has any more questions, I would rest and ask the court to do that.
Very well. Thank you so much. That case is submitted.